see it for the first time.
Besides the Princess Tours representative, offered public testimony. Another local businessman who had a competing proposal for the land decided not to pursue it. Five of the people who spoke out last night offered unconditional support for Princess Tours' proposal. Others had more questions they wanted answered. And then there were three people who simply want the land left alone. One of them was nearby property owner Marilyn Mann.
I live on the river. That wooded area should be left virgin exactly the way it is so that it can be used as a buffer between the industrial area. We do not live close to Pager Road, but I can hear the trains. I can hear the whistles. I can hear the engines coming and going. And we live a ways, and there's a lot of trees, and there's a lot of things in between. And I see constantly things being developed and torn down and changed. And it really has us a little concerned.
Mott also expressed disappointment that other property owners didn't turn out at the hearing. Princess Tours President Ray Patterson wasn't surprised by most of the things that he heard last night.
There's legitimate concerns in terms of the development itself or the use of the property for that. There's no question about that. Those concerns directed at protecting that piece of property that is not going to be developed in terms of that which is developed. That's as much of our best interest as our, because of our guests' best interest, than it is anybody else's.
The land right along the river's edge is left out of Princess Tours' plan, creating a green belt along the riverbank. An artist sketch of the 200-room hotel was presented last night. That and other details of Princess Tours' proposal will now be reviewed by the Railroad Corporation, which will also consider the questions raised by the public. Questions like the terms and cost of the lease arrangement, whether or not Princess Tours can't find some other land in town to build on, and what steps might be taken to ensure that more development in this area would not get an automatic nod to go ahead. There is about 80 acres of land there. Princess Tours only wants to lease 20 of them. Railroad President Frank Turpin says most of the things brought up will get a quick but thorough review, and then a proposal will be made to the board.
It'll take some time, but we'll certainly do our best to do that. And we'll present that to the board. See, we have one board member here who heard everything, so he gets it firsthand. And I made a lot of notes of the highlights in addition to the tapes. So I think we can manage that.
The Alaska Railroad Corporation's Board of Directors meets in Fairbanks next Friday to consider approving the lease agreement. Turpin says public comment will also be taken then. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. After last week's news from the Census Bureau that only 40% of people in the Fairbanks area had answered the census, Borough Mayor Juanita Helms decided to find out why. Especially since she had established a committee to help promote the census count, headed by Community Research Center Director Leslie Travola.
We will have the responsibility here in the Community Research Center to check when the preliminary numbers come back this fall whether we feel that they have gotten a concrete count. But that's how we're involved. And the best strategy to get a concrete count seems to me this spring to be that we would do a lot of promotion and make people aware of it. We've done an excellent job of making people realize hey, I haven't gotten a form yet. Oh, they haven't picked mine up yet. And that's a success problem simply because people are aware and the process is going slower than they expected.
That's part of the reason Provola says she's been getting lots of phone calls about the census count here, phone calls that should go to the Census Bureau. But they don't have a local phone number for Fairbanks residents to call for help. And that's one of the first problems that the mayor points out in her letter to the Census Bureau's regional office director. It was just one of the things that Carvola found while trying to determine why the return of census forms is going slowly. The other problems she found center around confusion. Confusing instructions over who should mail in their forms and who should wait for someone to pick them up. People concerned because they never got their forms, those who lost or destroyed their forms because they didn't mail them back by April 1st, and people who got more than one form have all been confused. Carvola says some of the problems can be traced right back to the Census Bureau, which said it would do one thing and then did another. So Carvola says the mayor wants to give the Bureau a chance to fix things.
She has itemized the specific concerns that we have here in Fairbanks and then gone on to say, we're not going to protest it right now. We're going to give you a chance to get it corrected. But I'm putting you on notice that we know you've got a problem, and if you don't correct it, then we will. We know we have got a good documentation that it's not our fault.
The letter was sent to Leo Schilling, director of the Seattle Regional Census Center. Schilling says he's heard about the letter but hasn't received it yet and wants to reserve comment until he has seen the specific complaint. Carvola believes the Census Bureau will make an effort to do the right thing, since the count is so important to the area. She points out that the borough will have to deal with the political ramifications of an incorrect count. Things like reapportionment and federal financial support rely heavily on the population numbers here. But Carvola says the Census Bureau has the burden of responsibility, since it's the only agency that can conduct the count. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Ogden Allies, the management firm hired to run the center, wants to spend nearly $200,000 on confessional equipment. The borough assembly agreed to that and will repay Ogden since the borough will eventually own the equipment. The assembly also spent another $140,000 up front for more equipment that's needed to run the center when it finally opens. According to Borough Administrative Director Rick Maven, that could be soon.
We do not have a time definite. However, we have made a certain amount of progress together with the city building inspector, city fire inspector, and the state fire marshal, with insert and we have a better feeling with what is happening and when we do it after that building to close as opposed to far away.
Ogden Allied may be able to get into the building by early May, but that's still 2 months behind schedule. That was why the final expense was called for. The assembly had to consider putting more than $170,000 into the center's bank account, since it's not yet generating its own revenue. And that cost was the only one which caused some assembly members to hesitate. Assemblywoman Donna Gilbert pointed out that they still may be able to get some money coming in before the fiscal year ends June 30th.
We are looking, according to Mr. Maven, at opening in the near future. I do not think that we need to tie up our money to stick it over into that fund, hoping apparently that we're not going to get it. It's April. We have all of May and June to see what happens. There's $250,000 of anticipated revenue. A great portion of that will still come in with the opening of that building.
But Gilbert was in the minority. The majority of the assembly sided with Bonnie Williams, who feels there is no way around the cost.
We have to pay them. We anticipated being able to pay the amount of revenue that will not be there on time because the building won't be there on time. Now, that's our problem. It's not Ogden's problem. We have to pay Ogden. We can have a white elephant sitting there and a lawsuit going with us if we guaranteedly will lose, or we can fund this thing. I suggest that we have no choice in this particular matter. We have a choice about going and backing different people and pointing fingers and things like that. but we have no choice about spending this money. We have to do it or we will spend more money.
The assembly members plan to take a tour of the new community activity center on Tuesday evening. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
Our offer had been reviewed by the owners and reviewed by the FDIC, who has to go along with it, and had passed the hurdle of being approved by the Alaska branch of the FDIC, and had been sent on to the regional office in San Francisco, assuming that they'll make a favorable claim. The next step will be for our proposal to be sent to the FDIC National Headquarters in Washington, D.C. It will be a write-off of a substantial amount and has to be approved by the National Board.
We are going through some very heavy budget considerations. We're densely considered. And I think by putting ourselves in a position where we committed ourselves, before we have a chance to really get a good look at the federal budget and to see what's going to have to happen. We were being foolish by giving them a guarantee of $18 million. We are giving ourselves a breathing room. We have a month yet before we finalize the budget and make a definite figure. So in the past, assemblies have gone with a dollar figure, and they have subsequently raised it. We've always raised it every year. This just gives us a little maneuvering room and doesn't commit us.
We need to stop trying to emulate each other within the University of Alaska system. UAA doesn't have to look like UAF. UAF doesn't have to look like UAS. I think when you talk about program duplication in the state of Alaska, you need to raise a whole variety of other questions. Business. We have schools of business that both the University of Alaska Anchorage and the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Could we serve the same number of students more economically and better in a combined larger program? I don't know. And so I think you need to trade off, or at least look at, those comparative costs and cost savings versus the accessibility of service. Who are the students of your service? Are they mobile? Can they go off to another community in the state of Alaska? And so I think it's a little bit simplistic to just talk about program duplication without looking at the consequences and alternatives that flow from that. I am clearly exploring other options. As you know, I haven't interviewed yet in Montana. I would need to gain some feel for what I would think the possibilities would be at that institution. I'm still really very happy with the chance of UAF. There's no dissatisfaction in that that particularly motivates me, drives me. I do recognize that I've been in my position in 9 years now. Maybe there's a bit of itchiness of steps looking for other challenges and opportunities going on within myself.
The bill is a bit of snowball legislation, touched off by a change in federal regulation. The Environmental Protection Agency has demanded inspections of thousands of underground oil tanks across the state, and where contamination has occurred, the EPA wants it cleaned up. The feds also want tank owners to insure their facilities, to the tune of $1 million to help pay for future cleanup. For small business owners, insurance and cleanup costs could mean bankruptcy, and so the Senate has proposed to help out. HB 220 would set aside $10 million for that purpose. There's also talk of grant money going to help businesses upgrade their facilities. But now it's not only small businesses who look to get state dollars. Larger firms and municipalities want their cleanup costs covered as well.
So what we're trying to do now is determine just how much of a problem it will be for municipalities to address those needs without state funding.
A strong supporter of HB 220 is Senator Steve Flint.
I think that when you start excluding people, you know, if you make a cutoff at a certain level of business or whether, as you know, as you're finding out, as I'm finding out when you try to exclude the municipalities, you wind up losing political support and you run into an issue of fairness. So Very possible that we'll wind up putting municipalities back in and not excluding anyone.
The last municipal league, representing boroughs and cities across the state, is pushing for that cut of the dollars. AML's president and mayor of the Mattoo borough is Dorothy Jones.
Why should municipalities be left out? This money will be coming from the general fund, which should be for all citizens of the state, and certainly municipalities are citizens of the state, and we will be faced with that. Yes, I've heard that argument about, well, you can tax yourself, but we get state-mandated programs all the time that they don't fund, and we, as taxpayers, have to pick up.
Even if municipalities are excluded, $10 million will cover only a fraction of the underground tanks affected by the new federal regulations. That means another dip into the coffers next session. Another issue is the Senate's plan to establish an oversight board. The Department of Environmental Conservation will set standards for the cleanup, and there's nervousness here that those standards will be too tight. The board would act as go-between, as tank owners and the DEC hash out how clean is clean. Again, Senator Steve Frank.
They haven't come up with their standards yet, and that's part of the problem. It's that uncertainty on the part of the legislature, I think, as a whole, and the public as a whole, that leaves us uncomfortable in just sending out authority over to the department.
Any time DEC's deputy commissioner says her agency sees the board idea as a major problem, the board would include tank owners and contractors, a composition, according to Kyle, that doesn't seem balanced. As it stands, the board would have control over some aspects of the cleanup standard, which Kyle says is better left in the hands of the DEC. With the federal regulations already going into effect, APT 20 is expected to pass in some form this session. Funding remains a major issue, with some House members calling for a gas tax. In Juneau, I'm Brian Mann.
It started when House Speaker Sam Cotton tried to withdraw his tort reform bill, which had been languishing in the House Judiciary Committee. The heads of that committee opposed tort reform. Trial lawyers and other opponents of tort reform who argue that these changes are designed to beef up insurance industry profits at the expense of victims' rights were suspicious that Cotton's maneuver would somehow open the door for tort reform amendments to suddenly appear on the floor. House protocol states that it's inappropriate to yank a bill out of a committee without the chairman's consent. But without any bill in the Judiciary Committee, the subject would be fair game. Cotton sides with those who argue that current court rules lead to excessive attorney fees and astronomical damage awards, which drive up rates. The Speaker was angered that he was not being allowed to withdraw his own bill.
I'm a little frustrated that the trial lawyers are able to have such a tight control over the legislature on this issue. I'm really disappointed.
A closed-door caucus ensued, after which the bill was allowed to be withdrawn. For the very next day, the House Labor and Commerce Committee introduced another comprehensive tort reform bill, which was promptly referred to the Judiciary Committee. Chairman David Donnelly, not known as a big fan of tort reform, says he introduced the bill as a courtesy to Cotton.
And in this case, we just wanted to make sure that this issue remained before the proper committee of jurisdiction, which was judiciary.
Whatever the intention, the result of Donnelly's action is that tort reform remains firmly lodged in the committee that does not intend to move it this year. And under legislative rules, bringing tort reform to the floor would be considered yanking the bill from that committee. Judiciary Co-Chairman Peter Gall of Haines says there has been no consensus on the bill. An attempt was made to add tort reform amendments to another bill on the House floor Monday, but that bill was pulled off the floor. Gall doesn't think that kind of maneuver will work.
Absolutely not. The committee system is going to hold. The majority is going to stay together, and public policy decisions are going to be made in an orderly and responsible way. I don't believe this particular bill will be heard from again this year.
Cotton agrees with that assessment, but he doesn't think the issue will stay dead.
They may have won with the battlefield. I think that a lot of people have become aware of the fact that there is a special interest lobby killing this legislation, and it's a I don't think anybody would necessarily continue to put up with that. So by nothing happening this year, perhaps we'll build some momentum for a portion of the issue next year.
I'm Speaker Sam Cotton, from Juno, and Peter Kenyon.
It's a fine university. It has an exciting faculty. It has, I believe, a supportive public. It's doing important work, and it's doing work that really is unique in many ways. The type of research that it does certainly is not replicated at many campuses in the United States. It works with a very heterogeneous student population. which adds talent and opportunity to the student. The future of people and of our communities is going to depend on more education rather than less as we go into a new century. And I'm very reluctant to talk about cutting programs. There's no question that the quality of programs should always be reviewed, and that one of the major tasks of the faculty and staff and administrators of the university and of the Board of Regents is to ensure to the public that what they're offering is first-rate programs and good quality programs. But I'm very hesitant to lessen service. I just have a feeling that our society needs more in the way of education rather than less, and that we need more opportunities for the young and for the old to learn and to grow. The University of Alaska is doing a great deal, but I think a great deal should be done as well. An interesting population and a large geographic area and outreach that the University of Alaska is known for needs to be continued.
3, 2, 1. The crew on duty this particular day makes for a very small group that gathers around firefighter Richard Dean. After 19 years as a Fairbanks fireman, Dean decided to take this early retirement opportunity, even though he knows it will continue the trend of fewer and fewer firefighters available to do the job.
I think the danger's increased every time you lose a man and you remember to cut down, the exposure is a lot greater. And also our ability to respond to multiple alarms or emergencies is really compromised every time you lose personnel.
Losing personnel is nothing new to the fire department. The first early retirement incentive program meant 8 firemen left on the same day back in September of 1987. On May 1st this year, 5 more firemen called it quits when they had the chance. George Bacon did. Bacon doesn't think public employees are very popular in Fairbanks these days. The tone of the community and changes in the department helped him make the decision to move on.
I guess I'm a bookkeeper for the continued history of this place. To any degree that it will be able to function as a real fire department. When I came to work here, it had nearly as many men on shift as could be totaled in the department now. 22 or 23 men on shift. And now we're down to 7 or 8. It's quite a drastic step backwards, I think.
Reducing costs through attrition has become standard procedure at the fire department and in other city offices. People leave and aren't replaced because the city can't afford it. Firemen are divided into 3 shifts, each working 24 hours every 3rd day. The number of crew per shift has been dwindling steadily. The Fairbanks Firefighters Association believes 19 firefighters should be on the job during a given shift, including engine companies at the now-closed Aurora and Southside fire stations. Firefighters Association President Jim Rice says the department has managed to stay fatality-free so far with a little bit of luck.
God's been good to us. It's been a marginal operation for a long time. I don't know how long we can keep that up. You know, we're down to some days having 7 people on duty. It's not adequate. Really, it's just public safety, you know. And really, see now, firefighter safety.
Fire personnel is not only dwindling, it's also aging. Rice says that's a concern because fighting fires is a young person's game. But the number of fire calls is increasing at its highest level ever last year with more than 3,200. Staff is at its lowest level now, down to 29. There were nearly 60 firefighters in the mid-1980s, and the risk factor grows for an aging department. The last time a new fireman retired was in 1986. Next week, Fire Chief Bill Schechter hires his first new recruit in 4 years. Schechter says he's got enough money in this year's budget to bring in someone new. Extra city council approved funds also allow him to recall 3 employees who were laid off at the end of last year.
We got recall, we got overtime, we got the promotion, got to retreat. And it's just kind of, it's just holding us together for the rest of the year.
Since the problem has taken a few years to reach this point, the blame can probably be divided over the years too. Some say the chief isn't a strong enough leader.
Just the opposite, I have been criticized for being too vocal at times. Some of those statements have come right out of the council for trying to fight very strongly for what I believe in professionally. So you're in a predicament. Some of your men feel you're not doing enough, and when you do enough, which you are, you get it from the other side.
Some blame the city council for not keeping enough firefighters on the job, but the city has had to do with less money overall. Firefighters Association President Rice believes the council recognizes the problem, since it agreed to give much of last year's surplus money to the fire department.
I want to commend them for committing that money to public safety. In fact, firefighters got the biggest piece of fire there. We got $390,000 of it. We all realize it's a band-aid and it's not enough, but it's a positive step on our part. Now, they're out of money. They're out of money. They're giving us all they've got. So the answer has to come from public awareness. The public has got to become aware of what a very fragile situation we're in here. We just do not have enough people.
Some firemen also fear that the city's history tells its future. In years past, major fires that have cost lives produced needed equipment and other improvements for the fire department in Fairbanks. They don't like to say it, but some firefighters believe change will only come when history repeats itself.
They haven't seen us do the job when we've got a code fire, a life or death ambulance call with a fire on the seventh floor of the Northwood building simultaneously. In that scenario, not maybe specifically that one, but one just like it, is going to happen. Sooner or later, it's going to happen. I think the public has to be made aware of the situation here, that we're courting a disaster.
For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
Last summer, the Moxie Borough tried to annex a large area north of its current boundary. The 10,000 square mile area would have included the communities of Campbell, McKinley Park, and Healy. In response to this threat, affected residents counted with a petition to create their own borough. The denied borough would include those same communities, but would also include Anderson. However, its northern boundary would stop short of Nenana. David Shaw lives near Nenana and is the major force behind yet another proposal that would include Nenana within its boundaries. Shaw says that when the Denali borough was proposed, Nenana was excluded because people there showed little interest in joining. Shaw and others thus moved forward to propose the Valley's borough.
We made the decision to go ahead and file the Valley's petition because I don't think that Nenana's going to be in a very, or I'm going to be in a very good position sandwiched between what's now the Denali borough and the North Star borough. Expecting the city of Nenana to represent me well in any way, shape, or form, and that they don't represent me at all. So I just felt that we should go ahead and do this and file it and gather signatures for the group. And that's what we did. So that's why it's there.
Recent recommendations issued by the State Department of Community and Regional Affairs are another cause of concern for Shaw. The department is on record favoring a Denali Borough proposal that would add Nenana to the original plan. Regional Affairs also feels that local residents should have the chance to choose between the existing proposals through a vote. Dan Bockhorst is a local government specialist with the department. Bockhorst cites actions by the Attorney General's office that led to his agency's recommendation.
Of course, the department held informational meetings in the region in each of the communities between February 20th and the 22nd, and that was a major issue at the time of those information meetings. People did express a preference to be allowed to vote on alternative propositions, and the department, frankly, would prefer to allow that to happen. However, the Attorney General's office is indicating that that is not a proper procedure. And our biggest concern with the Valley's proposal is the issue that is encompassing in their charter that provides or would require a referendum on any time the borough would appropriate any money, which is an extremely restrictive provision. We believe it's unconstitutional, and the Department of Law, the Attorney General's office, has agreed with that assessment.
The upcoming public hearings will be held before the local boundary commission. They act upon municipal boundary issues statewide and stand to submit the final proposal for voter consideration this fall. Attorney Mark Grober works for David Shaw and will be at the hearings to challenge the Attorney General's position.
We're going to go to the LDC. We're going to point out that the only statutorily approved way for them to proceed is to place both the Valleys and Denali petitions on the ballot and allow the people to choose among the three choices, the Valleys petition, the Denali petition, or no borough government. If the people choose no borough government, then it is likely that organizers here in the Valley will probably file yet another petition, simply to tie up the Valley and prohibit the Fairbanks North Borough from coming in.
The first of seven hearings begins tonight and will continue through Saturday. The Fairbanks hearing will take place Friday at 7 p.m. in the Borough Building. For KAC Local News, I'm Lee Bowman. After lunch, a large crowd awaited the panel discussion on subsistence. A few minutes later, Canada Chief President Mitch Dementev walked to the podium and asked for a motion to place the subsistence portion of the meeting in executive session. The delegates voted to do so, and all non-members of the Canada Chief were instructed to leave the hall, press included. According to several observers, this was the first time any portion of this year's convention had been held behind closed doors. Actually, the inside doors to the hall were not physically shut, and a number of excluded people hung out in a heated area just inside the main entrance to the building. The only thing heard at this point were muffled sounds from inside as the subsistence debate continued. Two candidates for lieutenant governor were also warming up by the doorway heater and talking politics. Bill Miller of Dot Lake Village took a breather from the subsistence discussion and offered some insight as to why Canada Chief delegates decided to close off the proceedings.
Village politics is a lot different than Western politics. You don't discuss everything openly and come up with a decision. The decisions are basically made and it comes out as a united answer. With people in there listening to it, they're going to get the idea that Tananau Chiefs, the villages in Tananau Chiefs are going off in 7, 8, 10 different directions, which may be the case at this time. But when it comes out, it'll be united and the board will stand behind it and the villages will stand behind it. And it's the only way they can get it without having outside pressures.
The Alaska Supreme Court recently ruled that the state's 1986 subsistence law is unconstitutional. It gives hunting and fishing preference to rural residents under a state constitution that prohibits such priorities. Governor Steve Cooper wants to change the state constitution to include a rural preference. Another proposed constitutional amendment would base subsistence on residency, dependence, and use. Native preference is still another subject of discussion. After the subsistence panel meeting, Canada Chiefs President Mitch Dementev said subsistence is the number one issue of the delegation. Dementev added that the closed meeting helped the group progress towards a position.
It was very important for us to get an open, frank, and honest discussion about the issue. And sometimes we need to do that just amongst ourselves. And such was the case today. We knew we were not going to make any decisions. You can't do that in executive session, but we just needed an open, honest airing of our views. And that's exactly what happened. It was a beautiful thing as we watched it unfold.
One resolution the group has passed proposes holding a statewide elders conference to discuss subsistence. For KAC Local News, I'm Lee Bowman.
Are now transforming large blue blocks of the solid material into works of art. This activity is occurring along the banks of the Tena River. Anyone wanting to see this annual spectacle can walk only a short distance to the work area behind the Denali State Bank. The work continues despite a setting sun, and the glow of thick headlights extends the work day as the chipping continues.
The first layer of blocks is the base. This second
second layer right here is the wingtip. This is the body here in the center, and then his head. This is a raven releasing the sun.
I'm doing this family of Canadian geese, and I want to get all the birds detailed out, and I've got to carve underneath the water. So I've got a tree back here, and I'm going to put some other animal above the water behind the tree, and the tree trunk's got to be underneath the water, and the branches. And
I'm used to working with large scale. So large scale comes pretty much naturally for me. What I did is I take butcher paper and just pencil it until I get the lines that I like, and then I literally paint the silhouette that I've cut out, and then I paint around it to get the outlines, and then you chip away until you get the outline that you want, and then you go back in and do the form.
Most of the people are doing massive things. I just wanted to do something really detailed, because that's what I do. So I'm just working on a much smaller scale that probably equally as involved in the project.
Very, very nice because of its color. We have a very big, the thickness is very interesting, but unfortunately it's a little bit harder than in some other countries. But I don't think it's a very big obstacle. I don't think so. We just have to sharpen the tools more often.
I love it. It's a resistant butter, but it's got a whole life of its own. I don't know how to describe it. You know, I've carved butternut before, that's a wood, but it's not, and it's softer than that, and it has no grain. The first time I ever picked up a chisel and put it to the ice, I thought that the chisel was warm. That's how it feels.
The lighting ceremony for the finished ice sculptures will be at 7:30 tonight. For KUAC Local News, I'm Lee Bowman.
This all started last December with a court ruling that overturned state subsistence laws. The state must now draft acceptable laws by July the 1st to face a possible federal takeover of wildlife management on federal land. As of evident on Saturday, this is an issue attracting the attention of the entire state. Several area residents waited 4 hours to testify to the commission, and when the time came, Stan Bloom of Fairbanks wasted no time in getting the committee's attention.
I would like to comment on the governor and the senator's resolution to change the Constitution to discriminate against the majority of Alaskans. Our governor ranks right up there with such distinguished governors as Sheffield, Lester Maddox, and George Wallace. His backhandle politics may even put him in an international league of I.M. Smith and C.W. Botha. In each instance, they use their high office to deprive the majority of their civil rights. Our apartheid is rural against urban.
That statement prompted a response from Commission Member Ron Zobel in Anchorage.
I have a comment, Ron Zobel. And Sheffield Governor Cooper with Governor Wallace, or Lester Maddox, I think is particularly offensive. When we consider that...
That's what it was meant to be, sir.
We're hearing all the cold words of racism in this attack on...
The Fulton Exchange is like this. The five citizens testifying from Fairbanks offered many comments and recommendations for the board to consider.
Well, what have the federal and state subsistence laws accomplished? It's a long list, but some of the highlights are these. An incredible divisiveness between natives and others. Longer and more expensive game and fisheries board meetings. More broken promises from the federal government. A plethora of court cases. An increase in the median income of attorneys.
Another one might be to have registration hunts, where you have to register a couple days ahead of time, you know, in that particular area. Or also perhaps make the first 5 days of a moose season a walk-in season. Certainly somebody who lives in that village who can go out several days ahead of time.
I think Supreme Court has already determined, not once but twice, that the state constitution, or the state law, or statute, on subsistence is unconstitutional to our Constitution. It should ring a bell with somebody. It is not a state problem. It is a federal government problem. Tell Stevens, who is supposed to represent us in Washington, and the federal government to get off their fanny and amend it out of federal law.
The Citizens Advisory Commission is now digesting the testimony and is planning their next move. Commission staff member Sam Leapart.
So what we're going to do now, I think the commission members, after hearing from all the people that testified last Saturday and looking at all the background information that was provided to them, they felt like they probably would be a little premature at Saturday's meeting in making any sort of recommendation. So they wanted some time to sort of digest what they had heard and what they had read. So what we have planned now is a teleconference meeting of the commission on April the 17th to discuss possible recommendations to the governor and the legislature on how we think they ought to approach the resolution of this issue.
No public testimony will be allowed during the upcoming meeting, but it will be open to the public for monitoring at the local legislative information office downtown. For KAC Local News, I'm Lee Bowman. The first race occurred 20 years ago in 1970. Over 20 million Americans took part in what some have called the largest grassroots demonstration ever to occur on the planet. At that time, man's attitude towards Mother Earth was changing as the signs of environmental abuse were becoming evident to more Americans. As a result of this first Earth Day, the Environmental Protection Agency was formed and Congress enacted legislation to clean up the country's air and water. The 1990s are upon us, and organizers of the 20th anniversary Earth Day feel that the time is ripe to rekindle the spirit of 1970. Tarika Lear is coordinating Earth Day activities in Fairbanks and says that the Tanana Valley Fairgrounds will be buzzing with a wide variety of events this Sunday.
Earth Day Fairbanks will be both exciting and very informative. You'll have a chance to hear 10 very dynamic speakers. We're going to have 30 terrific booths that will be covering all types of subjects because Earth Day is a very big umbrella. There'll be everything from energy-saving devices, recycling, solar power, alternate energy. We'll have cars that are fuel-efficient, resource management, world hunger. We'll talk about rainforests, global warming, and just goes on and on.
A number of Earth Day-related events will also be going on this Saturday, including guided tours of the Fairbanks landfill, an all-day film festival, and a 10-mile bike ride. Members of the Interior Delegation have been invited to attend on Sunday to answer public concerns regarding the environment. And a good variety of entertainment has been lined up to round off this year's full itinerary.
We will have some terrific talent for you to enjoy. We'll have everything from Cajun music to folk music. We'll have bluegrass music. And we've invited some pretty popular bands here in Fairbanks. In the evening, we're going to round it off with three concert bands, group bands. So I'm sure that whether you come here for the music, for the videos, or the issues of the 30 booths that will be at the fair, I think you'll have a very rich and full time and a live fight, and we'll even have food here for you to enjoy.
For KAC Local News, I'm Lee Bowman. On April the 9th, two intrepid travelers landed in Fairbanks to officially start spring for local people. This pair of Canadian geese also became the earliest springtime arrivals on record for their species at the old dairy. As it now stands, the number of geese has increased, and many can now clearly be seen from the viewing area on College Road. Heavy noontime traffic passes by as about 30 geese enjoy pond waters located only about 75 yards from the busy four-lane street. These birds have come many thousands of miles before stopping over in Fairbanks and seem to relish the public attention paid to them in this urban sanctuary. Pam Bruce is the manager of the Creamer Steel State Wildlife Refuge and knows the traveling habits of these geese.
Well, our geese are coming up from, these are Lesser Canada geese, and the migration route comes from California to Central Valley up to Oregon and the Willamette Valley and up to Washington. And then they come up to the middle of British Columbia and Yukon Territory. Some of them pass through the Kanawha Valley and migrate on up to Yukon Flats and Koyukuk, and some of them nest as far as Kotzebue.
For some reason, the geese show up at this same spot every year. Bruce said that these birds are a lot like salmon in that they use certain sensors to lead them to the same destination. Family dynamics also figures into the maintenance of this very important homing ability.
This is sort of passed by family groups. And in fact, when you're out here observing the geese, a lot of times you will see family groups still existing from last year. They mate for life, and sometimes their youngsters are still hanging around. And so you'll see maybe two or three, and they seem to be getting along, and this is the reason why. But it becomes a real traditional area, and they know that this place is here, and they come back. They can focus in right on, zero in right into servants.
Most of the geese at Creamer's are using it as a rest stop. When the birds are ready, they will continue on to roosting areas scattered along the vast Yukon River watershed. This year, the migrating flocks are being monitored closely by the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. They want to see if there has been any effect on the bird population as a result of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Rod King is a veteran pilot biologist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Fairbanks, and he puts the oil spill into perspective relative to the Tanana Valley birds.
As far as we know, we don't have any known returns of birds that come through the Tanana Valley Creamers and stop at Creamers Refuge that migrate through the Prince William Sound. The only thing that we would know that might come close would be possibly a few trumpeter swans. That would be the only thing that they would not, as far as we know, they would not go anywhere through Prince William Sound and end up in the Tanana Valley.
Over the next few weeks, a variety of other waterfowl types will stop over at Creamer's Field and give local residents the chance to view them up close. If you don't know the difference between a pintail and a widgeon, the Arctic Audubon Society will be on hand next week in the parking area to help you out. Reporting for KUAC Local News, I'm Lee Bowman. Thanks to wide media exposure, many people should have known about Earth Day 1990. In Fairbanks, activities would be centered at the Tanana Valley Fairgrounds, and organizers hoped for a large turnout. Well, apparently the word did get around, because by noon, the parking lot there was nearly full, and people of all types and ages had a big choice of things to do once inside. Music was playing, food was being served, and conversation filled the air as the crowds milled around the mini display booths. Ken Hayes represented the Central American Focus Group at their booth. He took part in Earth Day 1970 and has witnessed 20 years of change.
Well, when I participated in it in 1970, it was primarily a bunch of hippies, I guess, is what we were. And we were trying to encourage people to recycle and change lifestyles. And I'd say the difference is now those issues are still valid now, but it's gotten a lot broader.
The idea of recycling is gaining in popularity as we move into the 90s. Flower planters are the interest of Esther resident Bob LaFouche. The ones he had on display are cheap and easy to make.
What we have here is a pile of formerly nasty looking old tires. But with a little bit of work and a little bit of muscle, you can take this old tire, cut out a sidewall, turn it inside out, and bingo, you got a lovely plant. The best part is, now you don't have to go and pay big money for a heavy-duty, high-volume redwood planter, which takes trees. You can take something which is ordinarily going to clog up the dump and turn it into a workaday. The guy that showed me how to do it does it out in North Pole. Anybody wants to do it, for goodness sake, do it. You don't have the tools, the time, or the muscle to do it, find one.
A huge flatbed trailer load of crushed aluminum cans, baled and ready for shipment to a recycling center, caught the attention of Pat Reinhardt.
It says we've got to change our whole philosophy about packaging and stuff. It's a complete farce to think we're saving the environment by baling up cans, and we've got to change the industry, and the only way you're going to do that is by legislation, I think. You have to change the laws to make it profitable for the company to do it, or at least fine them so it's not profitable to do this.
Well, as the state legislature is busy with oil spill legislation this session. Although invited, no members of the Interior delegation could attend their stay in Fairbanks. Gina McIntyre is on Representative Neil O'Copernan's staff and was at a booth yesterday.
The Finance Committee called a meeting yesterday and probably for days before today as well. They're working on budget amendments and finishing closeouts.
The Green Party is well known in places like West Germany and is a new player in the Alaska political scene. From a booth nearby, Anthony Whitworth said that a new political agenda is needed in our country.
It's important for us to be on the agenda somewhere out there on the horizon, and let it be known that, you know, these interests exist beyond the Republican-Democrat deadlock stalemate.
As the afternoon wore on, families still continued to walk in through the front gate as others were leaving. Was this day worth the effort?
Oh, it's been a really good crowd, real interesting people. A lot of people we know from town, a lot of locals. It's just been one of the greatest things I've seen in Fairbanks in a long time. Good way to enter spring into the Fairbanks area.
I guess my first impression is that I'm really impressed with how many people have shown up today. I think it's today we're here just to reconfirm our belief in saving the earth.
I didn't really want to come. She just dragged me along and said, you'll have a bunch of fun. You'll have so much fun. That you better come. And now that I've gotten here, I think that I'm glad that she brought me because I'm impressed with how many people have come here.
Organizers hope that the public interest in the first day of 1990 is an indication that more people than ever before want to help Mother Earth move towards the 21st century as a healthy planet. I'm Lou Bowman reporting.
It's a sunny Saturday morning in late April, and eight local trainees are dressed in grubby clothes. Inside the Gray Line lot, the front bumpers are swung open on three motor coaches, exposing the spare tire compartment. Trainees today will learn how to change a 250-pound tire. Driver instructor Tammy Breckenridge kicks off the morning by showing everyone how to muscle a tire out of a storage compartment. If that isn't hard enough, students now will install a tire on the rear axle of a coach. This is a job requiring both brawn and brain, and Breckenridge demonstrates the proper technique.
Okay, we got a flatter. We're safe on the roadside. Our people are all out, happy, having a good time. Assemble all your equipment and get it to a place where you're going to want to work. We're all going to be working on rear dual.
You don't want to do this on your oil pan, okay?
There it goes.
look at these lug nuts. It's got a bevel on one side, and that goes in. So you get them all hand tight. Be very careful you don't cross thread them. And you can tell it'll be really hard to turn if it's if you're cross threading them. Oh man.
After a lunch break, the training team moves to a large parking lot near the international airport. It's time for an exercise known as collision avoidance. Driver reaction time is tested while they learn the maneuvering capabilities of a bus.
Anybody who drives any vehicle on the road has to go through. It's definitely a worthwhile experience. It really lets you know what the coach can do in terms of how it won't roll when you really make a quick, hard turn on it. And you know how your vehicle will respond if you have to really get out of an accident by steering as opposed to braking.
A few minor details now remain before new drivers from both Greyline and Princess face a busload of real live tourists. Each driver will work on things like learning the history of Fairbanks or practicing some narration while driving an empty motor coach through local streets.
Well, welcome aboard, ladies and gentlemen. As I said, when you boarded your coach, my name is Joe, and I'll be your driver guide during this afternoon's Fairbanks City Tour. A few things about the motor coach you'll be riding in. First of all, those bins overhead are hard.
Fairbanks tour buses carrying paying customers can be spotted on the road around the middle of this month.
If you're one of the unfortunate few whose head happens to come in contact with one of these, hopefully it'll be on that little red button. That way you'll get my attention and I'll be able to tell you I told you so.
For KAC Local News, this is Lee Bowman reporting.